Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com. This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 1, for June 14th, 2006. Dr. Susan Lindquist. Welcome to a brand new podcast on the TWiT Network. This is Futures in Biotech, with a name we have batted about for a while, and a subject we've batted about for a while. I've always thought that biotech is the next frontier in technology, and I'm very excited to be able to introduce our host to you. His name is Marc Pelletier. He is a postdoc researcher at Yale University, and works in a variety of fields in biotech, but approached me and said, let's do a biotech podcast. And I was so glad that he did. Mark, so nice to meet you. Nice to have you on board here.
I really appreciate it, Leo.
Tell me about your work a little bit.
Well, I can go into my work just a little bit. I've been told by the Yale sort of administration that I should keep it to a minimum.
You do not represent Yale in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, the ideas and opinions.
Nor do I, by the way. So just in case they see, they never sent me a letter to say that.
No, they didn't send me a letter, but they told me that was, you know, very Yale protects their name very strongly. But just to give you a basic idea, I was trained in yeast genetics and biochemistry at McGill in Montreal, and what you do as a postdoc is you find a lab, a great lab somewhere around the world. It's an opportunity to do independent research and tackle issues that are quite high risk, and it's just a fantastic opportunity to do what no one else has ever done before.
Is it kind of like a residency for a physician would be, where you're not quite yet a researcher, but you are, or what is it?
Well, that's how it starts off, and the salary is commensurate to that. Yeah. it's considered
too.
One of the worst jobs out there, because the hours can be very, very long. If you want to accomplish something in science, you really have to stay focused and put a lot of time.
But I have to say, I like what you said, which is that you can do risky research. You could, at this point in your career, you can try stuff that you might be unwilling to try when you're more established.
They always recommend a plan B. Make sure you have a plan B project. I tend to try and do things that are kind of risky, and then just work as hard as I can to make sure that I can get them to work. So coming to Yale, what I wanted to do is learn some biophysics, really, because I knew nothing of biophysics. So what biophysics, the field is, and more specifically structural biology, is to try and get an atomic resolution structure or a near atomic resolution structure of a protein. So we're made up of proteins, and most of enzymes and structural proteins, those that you'd find in your skin and stuff, it really helps if you can have a very, very detailed image of that protein, because then you can design drugs that can go knock out its function. And, for example, a polymerase inhibitor that might be used, or protease inhibitor that might be used in HIV. So, you know, there's two classes of proteins, those that are soluble, just like sugar is soluble in water, so they float around in the cell, and then there's those that are found in the membrane, right? So if you can picture a cell, it's like a beach ball, and then inside the plastic of the beach ball on the surface, that's the membrane, the plasma membrane. And 30% of the genome encodes for proteins that are in the membrane, yet they make up less than 0.3% of the structures, the atomic resolution structures in the protein structure database. So here you've got a situation where we've got 32,000 structures of soluble proteins from many organisms and many human, thousands and thousands of structures of human soluble proteins, but there's only two human structures for the proteins that are in the membrane. And yet that's, remember, 30% of the genome. And because of their position in the plasma membrane, right, they make up more than 50% of the drug targets, because they are what are involved in interacting with other cells and interacting with the environment. So that's what I tried, came to Yale to do, is to see if I could move a technology forward that would allow us to quickly identify those membrane proteins that will crystallize readily, you know, the ones that will be doable. So I'm still working on it, and we'll see if I can pull it off. And if I can pull it off, then maybe we'll start seeing the numbers go up in terms of how many of these proteins in the membrane we'll start looking at, be able to see them, basically.
So, and the implications are, would it be allow us better drug therapies, or...
Exactly. I mean, that's my rationale for doing it. A lot of people like to see see the protein that they're working on to sort of get a better understanding of how it works and its biological significance. But my main drive is to see if we can get some of the most important drug targets, proteins where if you could abolish their function, you could come up with a cure. So is to at least make those available, make those structures available so that you can actually see the protein. You have a model on your computer, then you can look at the chemistry, the local regional chemistry, and sort of design a drug that can go and turn that protein on or off. But that's enough about me. I guess this first episode, so people might have had questions of what's Peltier do at Yale. So
yeah, well, there you go. And of course, one of the things that's great about Mark is he because he is studying this field, he knows a lot of the people we should be talking to, and obviously I don't, and the average layperson doesn't. And we're going to start off with somebody very important. We're going to talk about proteins some more, and something called protein folding. What is protein folding before we get to our guest?
Okay, well, proteins, they're made. It's really quite simple how they're made. So there's a combination of amino acids. There's about 20, and they make up the building blocks of life.
All proteins are just sequences of amino acids, essentially. Well, yes?
All proteins are chains of amino acids linked up as sort of like beads on a string.
Okay.
Okay, and you can have various combinations of the order of the amino acids in that, on that, as beads on that string. But beads on a string as a line, they are all identical. There's no biological function. To have a molecule with chemical properties that can, as I said, be structural or enzymatic, you need to fold that into, you know, contort it, sort of like, you know, some of those derivatives of the Rubik's Cube that came out in the 80s. You know, there was originally the Rubik's Cube, and then after that, you saw these snake cubes and stuff. You could fold them and twist them on into a three-dimensional shape.
So folding a protein gives it different functionalities. It might have the same beads on the string, but the order that you fold it into can change what it does.
Exactly. Well, that's quite important to what actually we're going to talk about today, because you can have that same sequence, and that's one protein, it can fold into different conformations. They call it conformations, the different shapes. Mm-hmm. And one conformation can be functional, whereas another conformation can be lethal.
Oh, dear. And a misfolded protein is a serious issue.
Exactly. Our guest today is Susan Lindquist, and she's a member of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Sciences at MIT. She's a professor of biology at MIT. And she has figured out not only a lot of the mechanisms of how proteins are folded in the cell, but sort of the spectrum of biological functions relating to the end states of how proteins fold or non-end states, so when they go to disease state or to...
So a misfolded protein can cause Alzheimer's or mad cow or Huntington's or Parkinson's or a variety of well-known diseases just because they're improperly folded.
Well, we're going to talk about that with Susan, and her descriptions will be going to far more detail in a easier way to understand than
But that's what she's studying.
Pretty much. But she's made some amazing discoveries. For example, one of the proteins that assists in the folding of another protein, referred to as a chaperone. So here's a protein that holds the hand of a protein as it's being made and then helps it fold into its three-dimensional structure.
That's amazing.
She had identified one that acts as a capacitor or a buffer of sorts to evolution. So as genetic changes can occur, they don't necessarily translate to changes in the shape or form of the organism. You can have an accumulation of these genetic changes, but they're sort of buffered and held. It holds on to its form, and then all of a sudden, with the drop of this protein, this chaperone, you create a diversity, and it sort of leads to speciation. So she's identified basically the key to evolution. So,
wow.
In my opinion, it's one of the most interesting concepts in biology right now. And she gave a talk at Cold Spring Harbor that I saw, was it in year 2000? And it was probably the best scientific talk I've ever seen. So,
well, without further ado, let's get Dr. Lindquist on the line here via Skype from her office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We are really thrilled to get you on. This is something new for us because, as you probably know, I do technology podcasts, information right. technology podcasts, but I'm really of the strong opinion.
Yeah, my IT person who just came in here to set this up said, oh, I know him. I've
listened to him all the time. That's great. So I really think that the intersection of biotech and information tech is very exciting. And
I think it is too.
It's also, I believe that biotech is the next, you know, really the next frontier. So
I think it is in many ways. It's an extraordinary time in biology, actually, because we're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself. And then to actually be able to go from that knowledge to its application to really doing things for mankind, it's a very exciting time.
Yeah. Do you ever take a step back and just think about that the stuff you're working on is really changing the way people think about how we exist?
Yeah, I love that. it's a great feeling to be part of this. I feel, very honestly, I feel just incredibly fortunate. I think that what's happening in biological research right now is in, of course, I'm telling you my point of view, some from being right in the middle of it, but I think it's probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. I mean, to have be at a point where we're actually being able to understand how life works, I can't think of a more fascinating question. And it's actually happening. It's actually, we're getting a grasp on it.
Well, one of the reasons why I really wanted you on the show, and I really appreciate you doing this for us and being with us, as I was mentioning to Leo, you know, a lot of people study the mechanics of say, for example, protein folding and go on into detail, which has to be done, and
yes,
is very important. But your work tends to drive, you know, all kinds of fantastic, very interesting models that sort of motivates us as to why would we study the protein folding? Why would someone go after the details of you know, at the molecular level of a specific protein and a specific target? It's sort of very exciting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do try to keep a broader perspective on it and keep trying to put myself outside of what we're doing in my work directly and then looking at the much broader picture. And in doing that, I have to say that I have been extraordinarily fortunate to have really phenomenal people working with me. And they keep stimulating me in all sorts of different ways because they're always raising great questions and coming up with unexpected results and trying to put it all together. It's been a really interesting mix. My laboratory has got everything from chemical engineers to, you know, plant geneticists working together, and I think it's this really incredible stew of people with very different kinds of perspectives that that has really, you know, allowed us to take this broader picture.
To do science that leads to paradigm shifts must take a huge amount of convincing data. When you approach people to work with you, how do you convince them that, you know, early on in something where people are thinking one way and you sort of try to convince them that, well, there's a possibility that this is not actually the way, because you don't know it until you've gotten the vast amount of data.
Yeah.
How do you go ahead.
A lot of our real breakthroughs have come from working on something and getting really unexpected results. And in the beginning, when people start getting unexpected results, the tendency is to think, oh, I must have done something wrong and want to go back. And I keep trying to tell them that, you know, of course, one reason for getting an unexpected result is that you did something wrong. The other reason is that that it's something really much more exciting than your own initial narrow perspective was. And so often it's come from people having come into the laboratory to work on something else. And then we start to find one thing and then another thing, and the only way to put it together is to really come up with a paradigm shift. And then the scary bit is trying to get that published, because you, as you said, in order to do that, you have to have a lot of data. And I think that...
And not just from one lab. You have to sort of convince other labs to go ahead and do experiments with you to sort of corroborate that data.
Yeah.
Well, you've done an amazing job of this.
Thank you so much. That's really nice to hear.
Let me ask you a little bit about what you're doing, Dr. Lundquist. And remember, I'm the ignorant lay person here.
Okay.
So I think we've heard about protein folding, you know, folding at home and so forth. And Mark explained a little bit about what's going on. But this is the area that you're studying. Tell us what protein folding is.
Okay. So DNA is the code for life. It contains all the basic information, the blueprint, so to speak. But the DNA doesn't do anything. It's just got the code. It's got the instructions. And the workhorses of biological systems are the proteins. They do just about everything. So, for example, when light strikes an apple and your eyes perceive that, your eyes are perceiving that light because it's hit a protein in your eye. And then you realize what it is because proteins in your nerve cells wind up conducting electrical impulses to your brain, and proteins in your brain start interpreting what's going on, and then you decide you're going to pick the apple, and that's all muscles in your arms and your hand are proteins. The things that give the muscles energy to work are made by proteins. You bite the apple, you taste it, that the taste receptors are actually proteins. And then when you eat the apple and you start digesting it in your stomach, it's all proteins and enzymes that are involved in digesting it. So the workhorse, the nuts and bolts of biological systems are primarily the proteins. And they started out, their code was linear because DNA, as you know, is this double helix, which I think is the one molecule in biological systems that probably most of the lay public has heard about, the double helix. And they've probably seen pictures of it, too. It's this long, twisted ribbon. And actually, it's just, normally you see just a little snippet of it. It's a very, 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 very long molecule. But it's linear, and the code is linear. And that has to get translated. So that is read, little bits and pieces of the code get read into putting different amino acids into a long chain. So protein actually really starts out as a very long chain made of about 20 different amino acids. And the key to it is all, you know, which amino acids are in what places. Because each of those 20 amino acids has a different physical property. Some of them are sticky and like to be on the inside of a protein. Some of them love water and they like to be on the outside of the protein. Some of them are highly charged, and positive ones will fit with negative ones, but positive ones won't fit with positive ones, etc. So the string of these amino acids along the protein will give it a tendency for that long, long string. It might be 400 amino acids long, or even in some cases much longer than that. And it has to all sort of whip together into a very specific shape in order to function. So you can almost think of it as if you were to look at your hand and open up your fingers and just let them be completely loose and flap open, and that hand has got potential, just really can't do much. But if you close it up into a tight fist, that fist can now do something, and it can do something very specific.
How long does it take for a protein to go from that unfolded state to the three-dimensional fold set of folds? And is
there's
this...
a lot for different proteins. So some proteins can do it in a microsecond. It's amazing. They just have the intrinsic. They're small, and every amino acid has a tendency to just know just where it's supposed to go, and it's just because of the natural affinity of some amino acids for others, and they'll only fit right in a certain way. Other proteins take a long time to fold, and they often get it wrong, especially the larger proteins. And the more complicated the job the protein has to do, often the harder it is to get fold, because it has to actually not just fold in, for example, a fist. It might have multiple different parts of it, each of which is structured to function in a different way. One part of it might be out there in the environment waiting to bind a hormone, for example, and then if it perceives a hormone that's come floating by, it will grab onto the hormone, and then the other part of it goes into the nucleus of the cell, the command central of the cell, so to speak, binds to DNA and starts a whole new program of gene expression going. So those proteins, for example, are quite complicated, and they need a lot of assistance in folding.
It's the misfolding that interests you, I gather.
Yes. Whoa. In fact, we think misfolding of proteins is important in biological systems in an absolutely stunning variety of different ways. At the very beginning of all this, we knew that when cells were exposed to stress, that they induced a set of new proteins that helped other proteins fold. And these were called chaperones because they actually, the name is really quite evocative of what their function is. They bind to immature proteins and prevent them from doing things that they shouldn't be doing, going off pathway and making liaisons with other proteins that are improper. and then once the protein has matured and it's ready to complete its folding, they leave it alone and let it go ahead and do its business. So they're called chaperones.
That's amazing.
In the beginning, we kind of used to think of those as proteins that help the cell out under times of stress when proteins started having problems folding. We now know that, in fact, proteins are always having troubles folding. The cell is incredibly crowded, and biological systems get great efficiencies out of that because the proteins, once they've gotten folded, are so close to each other, you can pass an electron from one protein to another.
Wow.
And that really gives you tremendous efficiency. But it means that these proteins have to fold. They have to start out as those long strings of, as I said, 400, 500, 600 amino acids, and fold into these complicated shapes in the midst of being mother being jostled and bumped into by all these other proteins. So it's really quite a difficult problem that's going on all the time. And so proteins are, the cell has to cope all the time with protein misfolding. And we think that's why it interfaces with biological systems in so many different ways, because this problem is as ancient as life itself. It's been part of the sort of mechanism for life from the very beginning.
Is a misfolded protein a bad thing always, or can it be an evolutionary spur?
That's a good question. Sounds like you've been reading some of our stuff. We think that it's not always it's kind of a misnomer in some ways to call it a protein folding problem, because Mother Nature's pretty clever, and if she's been coping with something for a couple billion years, it's probably fairly likely that she's found out some interesting ways to take advantage of that. And so we think that, in fact, this very same kinds of, there's a variety of different ways in which protein misfolding can be beneficial. One is, for example, that when the cell is all set up for all these different proteins to be functioning and functioning very well, and there's what we call circuitries in the cell, where signals are being received from one place and they're feeding back messages into someplace else, and they're all being integrated by a variety of different signal transduction mechanisms, we call them, that these are really delicately poised, and they're functioning beautifully and exquisitely well when the cell is really well and happy. But when things start to get bad, things start to be stressful in the environment, for example, things can go off kilter, and that can lead to protein folding problems, which then amplify the effects of genetic variation. So you might have accumulated lots of little, instead of, it used to be thought that evolution worked in very little small stepwise pieces, one small step after the next small step, accumulating one little variant and then the next variant. But that's been actually one of the difficulties of understanding how evolution could be logical and plausible, because each of those small steps takes a long time.
So
it would be beneficial.
It would be beneficial to accumulate perhaps 10 or 20 different genetic changes that might lead to a change in shape of the organism. And then all of a sudden, under one stressful day, spawning variety of different shapes.
Yes. Well, so when you think about it, if you can accumulate, say, 20 different mutations, and keep them silent, so they have the potential to cause one protein to change its fold or to cause one pathway or signal to be perceived rather differently or something. But as long as the organism is not stressed, you don't notice it. Once the organism starts to get stressed, then these control circuit points are not working quite as well. Now all of a sudden you can see the effects of this hidden variation. And what's cool about that is that these variants have previously been silent, and they've been recombining and reassorting in every individual differently. So when stress occurs, you not only can potentially see the effects of these variations, but in each individual in the population, the effects are going to be somewhat different because it will have a different pool of these variants.
So this is and chaperones are involved in this. So by modulating the ability to handle stress, so chaperones are proteins that help a cell maintain the structural integrity of their proteins until and by having these chaperones, you can sort of resist genetic change. And then spawn that evolutionary step.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really interesting sortage that you're on, in effect. There's one particular chaperone that we think plays a particularly important role, and it's called HSP90, for heat shock protein 90. It's induced under stress like heat. But it's there all the time. And what this protein is especially suited to function on these signal transducers, these points in the circuitry of the cell where really big decisions get made depending upon whether a particular, for example, a hormone is out there in the medium or not out there, or whether new nutrient is available or not out there, or whether it's time to develop a tail and get some bone calcified, for example. There's a whole variety of signals that are flex points in this cell circuitry, and this particular chaperone is specialized to work on those proteins. They're very intrinsically unstable proteins. So,
HSP90 versus, say, for example, HSP70, which is another very abundant heat shock mm-hmm. protein. Mm-hmm. How would HSP70 and 90 differ for the selectivity for HSP90 to work on these regulatory pathways selectively?
Well, we think it's got to do with the fact that HSP90 really recognizes. Let me back up. HSP70 okay. is a real workhorse. I mean, it helps so many different proteins fold. So it's extremely important in every biological process. But what happens with HSP90 is that it has a much more specialized set of proteins. It seems to recognize and bind to proteins that are almost folded but not quite. And that, in fact, they're biologically set up not to always fold very well because they're not really meant to fold until they've gotten the right signal. So unless they've gotten that phone call that says, okay, go ahead, do something, unless they've bound to a hormone, they're not going to fold. Unless they've been modified for some other protein, they're not going to fold. Because they're meant to be receiving signals. And so they're kind of what we call metastable. They're sitting there. You know,
on the fence.
On the fence, exactly.
Those are the shapes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're on the fence, and they're functioning in a whole. You can think of a circuit board really on a computer, the complex integrated circuits. These metastable signal transducers are sitting at all kinds of decision points there, and then HSP90 is helping them to fold, so that in response to environmental stress, you can see that those are the flex points, the real intelligence of the cell, in effect.
Talking about circuit boards, I guess this is where Leo will come in and say dip switches. Because that's what I'm trying to figure out here is so HSP90 works on a subset of proteins that are very close to folded, but they can go either way, and basically it controls the dip switches to which the final shape of the organism is going to be and its ability to handle stress that's coming on.
Right, and because normally it's helping everything go. It's helping everything go very, very well, and it's keeping things robust in the face of all this genetic variation that might accumulate. But then under stress, it's having to work a whole lot harder, and it can't quite keep up. And so then these variations that have been accumulating in the genome and have been sorting and recombining, and they're different in every individual, then the effects of having reduced HSP90 activity and it not being able to keep up the circuits means that every individual you're going to see a different effect. And so we first found this actually with fruit flies, where we had reductions in HSP90 activity, and my God, we had a folded over abdomen in one fly, and then we had a funny looking leg in another fly, and we had a very weird looking wing in another, and odd bristles in another. It was just, I'd never seen variation like this.
How did you turn on or turn off HSP90? Or is that how you did it? You turned it off or turned it on, or stress? Did you stress the organism? Or do you get the same effect?
Actually, That was the key thing, in fact, just exactly what you said. We initially were doing it by genetic manipulation. We have mutations in HSP90 that didn't eliminate it because it's essential, but that reduced its function a little bit. And that's where we saw these very weird phenotypes in different flies. Phenotypes, is, by the way, is just a fancy term for sort of the whole gestalt way in which an organism looks and acts. Anyway.
Yeah, brown hair, blue eyes, and
yeah, exactly.
Blonde hair and green eyes.
Yeah. Hairy wings or unhairy wings. Really,
I'm thinking human. I'm anthropomorphic.
There's all kinds of strange names for these things.
You work with a lot of flies.
We've worked with, this first work started with fruit flies. Actually, we then went on to work with plants and showed that we saw something very, very similar with plants. And we're now working with fungi and actually with human cancer cells.
So it is universal.
Going on. We think it's very universal. It's really part of this very ancient networking aspect of biological systems and how proteins were set to go off in all sorts of different pathways and interact with each other and interface with each other. And so when you affect the overall circuitry by dialing in a change in protein folding, you can... It's very old, and it can really affect organisms in a wide variety of different ways.
You mentioned cancer. I want to put that one just on the back burner just for a couple of minutes.
Sure.
But it is a fantastic offshoot of your work trying to figure out, you know, basically the molecular key or cue to that regulates evolution. So you first started this work, you identified it in fruit flies, but then you went on to work with plants. It was, mm-hmm. Did you immediately want to begin, I mean, working with plants does require a green thumb. And if your expertise is in fruit flies, how did you go about saying, well, okay, all of a sudden now I'm going to get a greenhouse and start?
Well, interesting. I had a student working in my laboratory. Her name was Christine Quiet. She was from Germany. And she'd worked on plants in Germany. And we started talking about this project. And actually she was doing something that was actually... working with a different heat shock protein, actually a different kind of a protein remodeling factor, was starting out to do something a little bit more straightforward, and she did a really beautiful job on that. And then, boy, I just had in my gut, I had this feeling that I really wanted to see if this much broader, much stranger, and amazing kind of biology where you could just change the way the whole organism developed by changing the circuitry all at once.
Well, fruit flies...
We just tried it. So
fruit flies can fly away, though, but plants can't. So
I'm interested.
That's right.
Really,
so,
yeah. You mentioned that at first you tried genetic manipulation. Did you then move to stressing the organisms?
Yeah, we did two other things. What we used drugs that could do the same thing, so they could bind to this HSP90 protein and reduce its activity. And then yes, that was the key thing, was really to show that if this is going to be a part of normal biology, it's not going to be only occurring when you mutate HSP90 or when you happen to have a drug around that affects HSP90. Those are wonderful tools to use in the laboratory. But and although the effects of these things were really quite phenomenal and had big implications, we wanted to see, okay, wait a second, would this be occurring in a normal organism under normal circumstances when it gets stressed? And yes, we saw the same types of variations in the way the organisms developed that could be induced by just simple stress, as could be induced, that is, for example, growing them at higher temperatures.
So you've created
You've
created now a model for evolution for the punctuated equilibrium model of evolution.
Yeah, and I think it's only one. I think there will be many other things contributing to it, but this is one paradigm for how that could happen, that organisms don't have to have mutations accumulate in slow single individual steps. They can actually accumulate a lot of variation, have that sort of hidden from view for a while, and then in different combinations see what happens.
So I'm expecting, I guess, horseshoe crabs at one point are going to start changing. How come some organisms can rapidly adapt, and finches on an island, within an island population, can change to multiple shapes, just like, you know, the Darwin finches in the Galapagos. But how come horseshoe crabs are absolutely resistant to change?
Yeah,
does it reflect the HSP90 substrates? Maybe they don't have HSP90, or maybe, or
well, I'm sure that they have HSP90 substrates. It may be a number of different things. It may be that they've been living in an environment where being like they are is just fine, thank you. They didn't need to get accumulate any changes, and
they're never stressed.
They were very well suited to their environment, and when the finches got to the Galapagos Islands, on the other hand, there were all kinds of new environments to populate there, and so something that had a slightly differently shaped beak, that meant it could use a different food supply, and that would be selected for. So, as a part of all of this, natural selection is playing the central role. So, what we would think would be happening, for example, with the kinds of genetic variation that are revealed in an organism when it's stressed, and which are revealed through the stress on the HSP90 system, that just reveals an opportunity. It causes the organism, you know, to develop in a slightly different way. And that if natural, in most of the cases, those are not going to be good, because most novelties in nature actually really aren't good. But every once in a while, a particular combination might be beneficial.
And what I guess that's why you'd want to accumulate a number of them before you'd make the transition.
That's right, it's very interesting to think about the fact that the way this mechanism works, and it's just part of the natural way in which the HSP90 circuitry has evolved, is that you wind up trying out a variety of them in different individuals. What happened when we saw these effects on the fruit flies, we were able to actually then sort of step in as an experimenter and act as natural selection and say, well, what would happen if we thought that having this odd-looking leg or having this weird-looking wing was actually beneficial? So we're going to breed the guys together that have the individuals that happen to have odd-looking legs, the individuals that happen to have odd-looking eyes, or the individuals that happen to have odd-looking wings. And what happened then was that as subsequent generations went on, we were able to enrich that variation. So each of them might have only had about five or six different variants that contributed to that trait, but we kept breeding together the ones that had it. And that meant that we could get more and more and more of that variation into each generation. And pretty soon, we found that many of those traits, they would maintain those traits even when they weren't stressed, because the genetic variation that had only been initially revealed by stress now was enriched through generations by the action of selection.
I'm curious about something. So the misfolded protein actually then becomes part of the genetic material? So it can be propagated?
No, although there's another system that we work on that does seem to work that way.
We'll get to that. We'll definitely get to that. Yeah, we're almost finished on evolution, but go ahead.
Right. So what's happening is this misfolded protein, it's sort of like just a rheostat. The temperature gets turned up, or some other aspect of stress in the environment gets turned up, and the protein folding circuitry isn't working as well. And then you see these little variants that are in the genome that are altered proteins of other types that normally it didn't matter too much. But when the circuitry isn't going so well, it makes a big difference. But now,
can you take advantage of this to say, for example, select for crops that are now tolerant to high amounts of salt? Suppress, I guess, HSP90, or you just expose the organism to drugs.
We think that that actually could work. We originally were trying to patent that, but then we realized that it would be actually very hard to show that somebody had used that method to get that variation.
Because you can stress, but stress an organism and hope that it's like in the game Spore, that video game that's soon to be out, that Leo's talked about on his other shows, I guess, to spontaneously create these variations. But you were mentioning cancer before. Now's, I think, a good time to bring it back, because isn't that what you're trying to do, is sort of prevent the change, or do you want to induce change in the cancer cells to prevent them from picking a good survival
strategy. Cancer cells have this self-driven changing mechanism. Once it gets started, they're constantly seeking to be able to live in, to live despite the normal clues that should normally tell them to stop. They want to live despite other clues that should tell them to die, and then they want to start ignoring normal growth signals and grow even when there isn't very much hormone around, which would normally control their growth. There's this intrinsic, they become genetically unstable, and there's this intrinsic selective pressure operating on them to acquire more and more different states to acquire the ability to grow in another part of the body, for example, which is basically what metastasis is all about. And so, and to be able to acquire the ability to recruit blood vessels so that they get more nutrition and more nourishment. It's really amazing the evolutionary processes that cancer cells go through. And so we're starting to study this now, and it's still early days to tell whether or not we're going to have a big impact on this. But we think that one of the, well, it's not just us, everybody I think realizes that with cancer, one of the really, really difficult things is to stop it from evolving. If you might have, you know, 10 billion cancer cells in you, and you can eliminate all, with chemotherapy, you can eliminate almost every single one, but there's going to be, because they're genetically diverse, there's going to be a few of them in there that can wind up figuring out a new strategy to get around whatever it is you're doing. So once cancer cells have progressed beyond a certain level, what really is impossible for us to deal with is their ability, their fiendish ability to evolve a way around the various strategies we use to stop them. And so that evolutionary potential we're actually hoping may be in part fueled by this HSP90 mechanism.
And that so you want it activated, I suppose?
So we want to be able to control it and stop it in a variety of different ways. And we think it's going to take a multi-pronged strategy of this type really to stop cancer cells from being able to evolve. But it's a really complex biological problem. I think it's going to take a variety of different strategies. But I'm very excited about it. I think it's an aspect of where, you know, work that we had done in very basic biological systems, trying to understand, well, how does this life thing work? How does this biology work? How do you get different states of being with the same, you have the same genome, and how does that get decoded in different ways? Understanding how that happens now in cancer is both a phenomenal intellectual exercise. It's just an amazing problem. But my very great hope is that we might be able to make a difference someday by understanding how these cancer cells evolve.
Are the compounds that you were using on the fruit flies, or are they being used? Are those the direct compounds that you're using and would possibly use in clinical trials? And
they're being used in clinical trials right now in several different cancers. And there's an enormous number of different laboratories that have contributed to this. But I do believe that we need, this is a very powerful tool we're applying, and we need to understand it better than we do right now.
When you first began this research, was it aiming at the disease end of it, and were you surprised to find the evolutionary benefit of it, or did you have that in mind?
We kind of stumbled on all sorts of things, and this has sort of been something that's happened again and again in my life. We set out to do one thing. We were really trying to understand particular types of ways in which HSP90 contributes to protein folding, and particular little pathways and particular little circuits. And all of a sudden, boom, you know, we got the strangest results. And we could have just thrown it out and just said, oh, this is a mess. It's a developmental nightmare. We're just messing everything up. But, you know, we stuck with it, and we noticed that in individual genetic stocks of flies, they would always get the funny-looking legs, and a different stock would always get the funny wings. So that told us, well, we weren't just messing things up in some non-specific way, but they were doing something that revealed hidden variation that had already been there in that stock. And so it was just kind of by a guess and by golly, we just kind of kept going and kept stumbling on more and more things. And then it was oddly, I had worked on one particular protein that's involved in what's called a transformation of a normal cell into a cancer cell many, many years ago. And then it's turned out I'm returning to that cancer problem again, very, very unexpectedly, in a much broader way, encompassing lots of different circuitries.
There's a significant number of other diseases where protein folding is involved. And actually, cancer until recently was not really thought of or could be thought of as tackled by going with the protein folding route.
So
you've engineered. It says in your on your webpage that you've engineered some yeast to carry on some protein folding diseases, and you hope to use them to identify molecules that sort of can reverse the end state of these?
Right. We're really excited about this. The thing is that this problem of protein folding is so ancient. It's really part of all biological systems, and especially by the time you get up to a fairly sophisticated cell that's got a separate nucleus and an energy factory called the mitochondria and lots of different membrane-bounded compartments, even simple organisms like yeast, that is the organism we use to leaven our bread and to turn grape juice into wine, that same lovely organism that man has been taking advantage of for so long. Turns out it's a phenomenal organism because it grows very fast, has a very simple genome, and yet what its cells are doing are really quite uncannily, has a lot of the same problems and a lot of the same things that our higher organisms do.
Genome is what, 70%? 80% identical to human? Is it?
Yeah, not identical. But there's about 70% of the proteins are directly related to human proteins, right?
So we're 70% yeast and 30%
beer. well, for example,
that's not why we enjoy beer.
Yeah, well, I think we have a real affinity there.
cousins. We're cousins.
it's really been an amazing one of the revelations of biology over the last couple of decades is how even though evolution has produced all these amazingly different forms and functions in the biological world, that the basic elements, the basic ground rules, and the basic pieces that put it all together are really very highly conserved. So anyway, we've taken some proteins that are involved in some pretty dreadful neurodegenerative diseases, things like Huntington's disease and Parkinson's disease, proteins whose misfolding, you know, causes ghastly things to happen over the course of a decade in a human brain. We've put them into yeast cells and asked whether the proteins will also misfold in yeast cells, and there we find that they do, and in fact that they'll kill the yeast cells. And what we are very hopeful about is that they seem to be killing yeast cells in ways that are really quite related to the ways in which they kill the neurons.
Do they just destroy from sort of like explode from the inside out, or is it
They seem to be doing what's really very interesting about this is we could well have expected that if we would bring in proteins which misfold in various different diseases, and in the brain they misfold and they accumulate as these big blobs in the cell that they're really ugly looking, and pathologists to tell you after you've died they can tell which particular disease you died of because of the particular protein that's misfolded in these blobs. But you might well have thought that, well, they would just do something very non-specifically toxic inside the yeast cells.
Yeah, you'd think they'd just destroy destroy cellular structures.
And that could have been interesting too, but what happens is each of these proteins, when we put it into yeast cells, and then what we can do is we can take advantage of a tremendous amount of yeast genetics that's been done over the last decade. We can actually ask one by one every single gene in the genome, what is its effect on this misfolding of this protein, and then the ability of this misfolded protein to harm the cell. And so we have about 35 to 40 genes that affect the toxicity of the protein involved in Parkinson's disease, and we have about 30 or 40 of them that affect the toxicity of the protein involved in Huntington's disease, and there's practically no overlap. Mm. So although they're both misfolded proteins, and they both damage the fundamental functions of the cell, they really do it in very individual ways. And that's very exciting to us because we think that we can then use yeast cells, because we can grow them so cheaply and easily, as ways to interrogate the system and try to make it better. And so we've just actually very recently collaborated with three different laboratories. We found some genes that could rescue the yeast cells that were expressing this Parkinson's disease protein. And we called up friends and collaborators who were working on different organisms, had different model systems for Parkinson's disease. The first one we looked at was a nematode, which is a very tiny little worm it's pretty simple, but it's more complicated than a yeast cell, and it has neurons. And so someone had made a model system where they expressed the Parkinson's disease protein in the neurons of this little worm, and they could get those neurons to die. And we gave them a protein that we'd picked, a gene that we'd found in yeast that we thought could help things out, and sure enough, it helped fix the neurons in this nematode.
Wow.
Then we did
Was
the
it progressive, or did it... with the worms, was it
progressive? It's age-related. Yeah, it's age-related.
Wow, and worms too.
So, and the same thing in fruit flies. So that was with Guy Caldwell's laboratory, and with Nancy Benigni's laboratory, we worked on fruit flies where they again have Parkinson's disease causes this very specific loss of dopaminergic neurons, a particular type of neuron. And sure enough, when we gave them our gene and asked would this help in any way, it did. It didn't completely and absolutely rescue them, but it did a lot. And then most recently, we got some results from a collaborator, Chris Roche, who and this is a very laborious test, and that shows you why it's useful to be able to do things in yeast. What he does is he takes the midbrain regions of embryonic rats, and he puts them into culture. And over the course of several weeks, put certain stresses on them that are known to be associated with Parkinson's disease, and he winds up seeing that these particular class of neurons, the dopaminergic neurons, start to die. And when we gave him our gene that helped to rescue the yeast cells, sure enough, it helps to rescue these dopaminergic neurons from embryonic rats. So we certainly have a long way to go then from there to a person, but it does make us believe that what's happening is that some of these diseases, at least, that seem to be very specific neurodegenerative diseases are really diseases in normal cellular processes that many organisms and many cells share, but that because of the particular structure of these neurons and because of the particular difficult jobs that they have to do in their particular own niche in the brain, when that process is perturbed, they're more sensitive. So they're the cells that die first. So it looks like a very selective disease from that particular cell type, but really in some cases, at least, we hope it's a general cellular problem that can be approached in much simpler organisms.
One thing that the audience might like to know is Parkinson's is the result of amyloid formation of a specific protein. Is it?
Well, it's not quite. It's associated with amyloid formation of a specific protein. It's not quite sure if it's the amyloid per se. The mature amyloid fibers that kill you, or is it an earlier, more molten, more reactive protein misfold that actually is what's dangerous?
So what is an amyloid?
Amyloid is a really tough folded structure that it's sort of like, egg white and egg yolk, there's a lot of proteins in that. And when you first, if you were to crack open an egg and sit it on a plate, you could wash that off really, really easy. But if you let that dry on a plate, it's really hard. It's really hard to do anything with it. That's the kind of a difference that occurs when you make an amyloid. Amyloids are a structure that are just, they're really tough.
So and, that would suggest that most people would think that that's really what causes the pathogenesis. Yeah, so it's really not. You're saying that the evidence is leading away from that.
Yeah, it's leading away. It's not clear by any means. And in some diseases, it might really be the amyloid. But in the neurodegenerative diseases, it looks like the amyloids are the big globs that when you first do some examine nerve cells under the microscope, that's what you see because it's a big blob. But it might be actually the little tinier misfolded proteins that are actually more reactive with things that are the really dangerous stuff. So
I've been fortunate actually to see amyloids under an electron microscope, and they form these very, very small wires or cables.
Right.
So you've done some work to sort of take advantage of these for technology?
Right. We're trying to anyway.
This is a whole other area, the nanotech.
Yeah, it's a whole other area, but I'd like to take this off on that little tangent and then bring it back to possibly talk about how amyloids differ from prions, and I'll let Dr.
Sure.
Lindquist explain that. But sure. On this little nanotech branch, what are you trying to do with what can you do with?
Well, what we found was that this one particular amyloid that we were working with self-assembled extremely easily in a test tube all by itself. We think, in fact, that it's biologically meant to form an amyloid. So this is a case where an amyloid is not bad. We think it's actually beneficial to the cell.
Is it the one I'm thinking of? Or can you, is it
the yeast
reveal
prion?
Any? Okay.
It's a yeast prion, yeah. So it's called a prion or prion. And that word scares a lot of people because it's associated with mad cow disease.
Yeah. Yeah.
You bet. And that is a very frightening, scary disease. It's a horrific disease to die from. There's nothing we can do about it at present. And it's transmitted in a way that we're beginning to understand, but is a very strange thing. But what we do know about that disease is it seems as though what happens is that a protein misfolds in an unusual kind of way that makes it act as a template for other proteins to misfold. And so it sort of starts a protein chain reaction.
We need chaperones.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, chaperones can intervene with in these processes.
You're going down the wrong path. Change your life.
Yeah. But I think amyloids are particularly interesting in their structure. If you look at them, they don't use the same chemistry to fold as typically the side chains of an amino acid.
That's right. They use the backbone primarily, although some of the side chain interactions are amyloids are. A great mystery of protein biochemistry because the usual methods we use to figure out protein structure, just you can't use them on amyloids. They're defiant beasts in many ways. And so we're still really only the very beginning stages of understanding exactly how they structure, but it does look as though it's the backbone of the protein rather than the side chains of the protein that fit together. But anyway, so we found that this protein would self-assemble. You know, it would sit in solution and it would be perfectly soluble. But if you once took a small amount of the amyloid form of it and added it to that soluble solution, just in a matter of a few minutes, it would convert all of the soluble protein, this protein that's slushing around in solution, it would convert it all into amyloid fibers. And it would just template.
A nucleation of sorts?
It was a nucleation event that would template this conformational change reaction, yes, and remarkably efficiently. And when we looked at the products of that reaction, there were these beautiful, very uniform fibers, which unlike many other amyloids which create big globs and clumps, these things were very beautiful. They, under looking at them under the electron microscope, they did not clump together. They formed really nice, long, 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 long fibers.
No branching?
Very, very little branching. So although we by attaching things to the sides of the fibers, we think we can get them to branch when we want them to branch. But what was really interesting is that these things were very, very tiny. They were 10 nanometers wide. So very, very, very small, something on the order of 1/10,000th the width of a human hair. So we got the idea, these assemble so nicely, it might be possible to make nanoscale devices with them.
And they'd be strong based on their backbone.
They'd be strong. Yeah, they'd be strong. And because we knew we could genetically modify them to carry different functions on the side of the fiber, that potentially you could build them to use them to build all sorts of things. And so as a proof of principle...
That's very creative, by the way. That's very... I never thought that, you know, that somebody would try and take advantage of mad cow in this way to turn it into a... Can they conduct electricity, or can they be used to...
So what we did was we put a metal binding domain, a residue on them, so that they would bind a gold particle. And then we used a reductive plating process that basically you can have gold and silver in solution, and once it has a nucleus to plate onto, it will assemble onto there. So we were able to actually, using these little tiny little gold particles that we had genetically altered the fibers so they would bind the gold, then we could reductively plate onto those fibers metal. And then we collaborated with this fabulous lab at the University of Chicago. This is before I had moved, Heinrich Jaeger's laboratory. And they were physicists who were very interested in electronic circuitry and how electrons move between molecules. And they had built some very, very, very tiny circuits that they could, they were just like a micron or less wide. And so we put our metal wires of this protein down across them, and they were able to show that, in fact, they did conduct electricity.
That's unbelievable.
It was really cool. I must have to say, I'm just really excited.
So you've
really
not only discovered the effectively
evolution,
the steel of nanotechnology, but you've also now discovered the electrical wiring of nanotechnology.
Yeah.
Well, we hope it can be used in that sort of way.
That's amazing.
We think it could be used in a lot of other ways too, and actually, it's really just a tremendous amount of fun. Unfortunately, my lab has kind of gone off in other directions right now, but I'm still hoping that will come to fruition in terms of nanoscale device building in other ways.
I'm really impressed by the wide range of your studies, Dr. Lundquist.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, evolution to nanotechnology. Yeah. Just for the industry folk that might be listening, did you attach a cysteine to attach
exactly.
a gold label? Okay.
Yes, that's exactly what we did. Yeah. We have one other industry-related thing that we've been doing lately that maybe I'll mention. It gets back to this yeast business of using yeast as workhorses for discovering aspects of biology that are important to human medicine. Those cells that I told you about that we had taken that Parkinson's disease protein and put into mm-hmm. those cells, and so they're dying by virtue of the fact that they have that protein. Well, yeast cells are very easy to grow and very cheap to grow, so you can imagine that we could set up hundreds and hundreds and thousands, in fact, of little assays for compounds that would return them to growth.
And, did you hire on Coors or Budweiser to make the yeast for you? go ahead.
Well, this is something that's really wonderful about modern biology is that there are many different people working in many different places doing different things, and collaboratively you can do more than you ever possibly could do. So in this particular instance, we collaborated with the Harvard Chemical Genomics Center, and they had chemical libraries of hundreds of thousands of different compounds, and they had things set up so that you could actually get little tiny little bits of these compounds and test them in your assay. And we had our assays
the Cambridge
miniaturized.
Library?
Cambridge was one of them. They have several different libraries of that type. And we were able to, it's a very simple screen. We asked for compounds that would return the cells to life. So it really was nice because it gets over three problems in drug development. First of all, it has to work. It has to do something important in terms of this toxic protein. It has to detoxify it. It has to be able to get into the cells. And sometimes when in drug companies, look for an assay for a particular compound that might have a particular biochemical effect. It's sometimes hard to get those compounds into cells. And moreover, it have to not be toxic to the yeast cells themselves.
Well, yeast are particularly hard, aren't they? They have pumps that pump out all kinds of compounds.
We had to disable the pumps, right? A very, very good point. Yes, so there's, again, take advantage of the fact that other people had figured this out, that there was a problem with the drug pumps, and we knew what mutants to make to prevent them from pumping out the drugs. And so we have that's been one of the platforms that we've used to form a company called
FoldRx.
Uh-huh. And that one of their objects is to try to use this kind of a platform to discover compounds that could actually potentially be used as drugs. And so we've taken some of those compounds, and they, again, using this is unpublished work, with these collaborators that I mentioned earlier in nematodes and in rat cells, and they do seem to be rescuing the neurons there. So we're very hopeful.
That's amazing.
We're very hopeful. There's a long way from there to drug development, but
about $800 million.
It would be impossible
dollars.
To try 100. Yeah. It would be impossible to screen through 150,000 compounds in any other, in a mouse, for example.
Well, there are high diversity libraries that are small scale in size, I guess, and some of them are off patent drugs as well. Have you thought? Well, I'm sure you guys have thought about trying those as well.
Yes,
there's two strategies in drug discovery is to go with a small, very specific type of library that might be workable close to what looks like a drug, and then the every possible combination of a compound that could be out there.
Right. So that's really interesting. That really works well when you know exactly what you should be doing. When you know that there's a particular protein and you want to inhibit that protein and you have one compound and you know what kind of fits and you want to find out every single possible combination that might work better. But with these neurodegenerative diseases, one of the chief problems is that you don't quite know what to do. So you know that a particular protein is misfolding, and that's causing a lot of problems. But you don't know whether the best thing to do would be to find something that would bind to that protein and prevent it from misfolding, or whether it would be to find some compound that would then encourage the cell's own machinery to chew up that protein and get rid of it.
So either a chemical chaperone or a foldase,
yes,
or an unfoldase.
Or a protease, stimulated protease, or bind to a partner protein that will then interact with it and prevent it from misfolding. You just don't know what you really want to do or whether you want to get around the problem some other way. On many of these,
you'd have to do both.
I
couldn't imagine somebody. If you have a patient that has predisposition for Parkinson's, I could not imagine you not, if you had a compound that could act to stabilize the protein to prevent it from the unfolding, that you wouldn't want to put them on that drug for the entirety of their life to prevent the onset of the disease. And then, God forbid, somebody went undiagnosed, you'd want to have an enzymer that can unfold the protein or a protease that could go in and tackle. I guess you'd have to tackle it from all angles.
But, yeah, you have to tackle it from all angles, basically. And our strategy was to say, we don't quite know what to do. Let's let the cell tell us what makes it better. So that's what we did genetically, and that's what we did with the compounds. We just tested 100. We tested every single gene in the genome to see which ones would fix the cells. And we tested 150,000 compounds to see which ones would fix the cells.
Is that the knockout library of
yeast? The cells told us. The cells grew better.
Okay. Is that the yeast knockout library where they've knocked out every single gene of yeast?
So we've looked at that, and we've actually found another library we think is working even better for us. And that's a library that's just been made. It's been made by the Harvard Proteomics Center, and we've been collaborating with them to get it finished. But what it does is it puts every open reading frame, or this is every genetic code for protein, behind an inducible promoter that we can turn on or off anytime we want. So we can put it into the cells, and we array thousands of cells. Each of them have just one gene, and that gene is silent until the time that we want to turn it on and ask whether it will save the cells from the Parkinson's protein. So that's actually a cleaner way of going about it genetically, because we haven't perturbed anything about the cells until the point when we want to do the assay. And as you know from that deletion library, one of the things that happens is you've made a mutation in a gene, and then so meanwhile the cells start to evolve and other things are happening in that cell. That's been a very, very useful library, but I think this new one is even better.
Well, Dr. Lindquist,
I'm afraid I might have to go.
I know you're very busy with a lot going on, and it's very clear, and I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been just fascinating, I have to say.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it myself. You really asked great questions, and
thank you for doing this.
Made it a pleasure.
Thank you. Dr. Lindquist is a professor of biology at MIT and a member of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research, and we thank you for your time, Dr. Lindquist. Take care.
Great to make your acquaintance.
Thanks.
Take care.
Have a good day.
So that was Dr. Susan Lindquist, who is a member of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research and a professor of biology at MIT. And you mentioned, and I don't know if it's, I certainly wasn't going to say it in front of her, but then it's probably impolite to even say, but you say, Mark, she's on the Nobel track, as they say.
Oh, definitely. Her work sort of covers everything from evolution to cancer to neurodegenerative diseases.
And to nanotech as well.
And not only getting us a better understanding of the processes involved in all of these, but actually trying to go out and fix them.
Yeah.
Really setting amazing. Up companies to tackle these. So there's no question she's doing some fantastic work, and one of my favorite scientists, certainly, to listen to.
Fantastic. Next week, we have Mark Vidal is going to join us.
That's right. So Mark Vidal is at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and a professor at Harvard. And in our field, we sort of refer to projects that are huge as Vidal projects, in that he was one of the first people to go out and clone every single gene of an organism, and that was of the nematode worm that
Big
Dr.
Bio.
Lucas was
we'll
talking.
Be yeah. Big Bio next week.
19,000 genes this guy cloned. So he had to reinvent how we clone genes.
Amazing.
And everybody now uses his method, and we'll talk about what he was doing. He's basically creating a map, one that you could resemble sort of Google Maps of the cell, in which we see, you could sort of down to the molecular level, who's interacting with who, what proteins are interacting with what proteins. And when you're talking 19,000 proteins, you definitely need a map before navigating.
For more information, you want to take a look at the links to Susan Lindquist's research and upcoming episodes. Mark has set up a blog called Futures in Biotech. It's at futuresinbiotech.blogspot.com, and you can find out more there. We'll get all the show notes there. I'm going to let Mark write the show notes since I have no idea what to say. What to
That's
say
okay. It'll take me a day too, though.
And I love our music. You want to tell folks who's responsible for that?
Yeah, the band is called Gunther, and they gave us permission to use their song "Wrecking Ball" as a theme for Fib.
And appropriate, I think, in some ways, since we are talking about the wrecking balls of biology. And
maybe. That's a stretch. But you can find their music at www.cycloneRecords.ca. So it's a Canadian record company.
Great.
And I'd like to also thank Harry Gill and Mark Parker for their help on the blog. They're going to make sure that there's not too many typos. And when you're typing BioBabble, you can't use a spell check. So they've been very helpful, and they'll help in the future. And I'd like to thank August Sanders for helping set up Skype at MIT.
Great.
For Dr. Lindquist. And we did the disclaimer, didn't we?
Yes, do your disclaimer just to so that the people at Yale don't get mad at you.
Yeah, they don't take my house. So the ideas and opinions presented here do not reflect the ideas and opinions of Yale School of Medicine in any way, shape, or form.
No fruit flies were harmed in the making of this podcast. However, we do thank Cashfly for providing us with the bandwidth for the podcast, a great service for people who need bandwidth fast, cachefly.com. We're out of time, but we will see you next week on Futures in Biotech.
Have a good week, and thank you, Will.